Joining me is a man who has given a lot of thought to why dirty jokes are so funny and double entendres, and he's done a lot of research into all of this. My guest is Ralph Allen, who wrote the sketches and did the research for the burlesque musical that's now playing in Philadelphia and will soon be moving to New York, called Sugar Babies. He's also written a book that will soon be published on burlesque, a book called Gaieties. Ralph Allen is from Philadelphia, but now he's a professor of theater at the University of Tennessee. He's written extensively about the theater and is the co-author with John Gassner of Theater and Drama in the Making. He's also the author of four plays, one of which was co-written with Joshua Logan. Ralph Allen, it's a great pleasure to have you here on Fresh Air.
Thank you very much for having me, Terry.
Before we get into talking about burlesque and why it's funny, and tell us what burlesque is and what it isn't.
Well, I think some people, young people especially, coming to our show might have expectations that won't be fulfilled because burlesque has come to mean a kind of pornographic entertainment, but burlesque was not a pornographic entertainment. There was no striptease in burlesque until about 1930, for example, and it was a classic variety entertainment at the turn of the century. It developed out of three main sources. In the late 19th century, variety entertainment meant minstrel shows, for example, which were clean shows. They were shows I'm sure that most modern liberals would find offensive, of course, but they were clean. They were family entertainment. I mean, men and women could go to it without blushing. They were all male performances, and they were in three parts, minstrel shows. They were done in blackface, of course. The first part was a series of questions and answers between an interlocutor who was like the straight man in a burlesque show and men who are like the comics in the burlesque show, and they sat in a circle, and in between them were soloists and chorus performers. And then there was a second part, which was an olio of variety acts, and the third part was an afterpiece, a burlesque of something, of a legitimate play or something. And most of the stock burlesque scenes, a great many of them, developed from minstrel show afterpieces in the 19th century. And about the turn of the century, an entrepreneur called Michael Levitt combined some of the features of the minstrel show with some of the features of English pantomime and burlesque and kind of created the American burlesque show.
What are the boundaries of taste in burlesque? What is the kind of thing that's a good double entendre and is fair to include in burlesque? How much flesh can you show in burlesque? And what in the parameters of burlesque is going too far?
Well, I have to say, now, burlesque was always a little rowdier than the legitimate entertainment of its period. But these are all matters of degree, as you know, and what was rowdy in 1905 would seem very tame by contemporary standards. The period that we pick for our show is 1905 to 1930, which was the kind of glory period of variety entertainment in this country. There were great vaudeville circuits and great burlesque circuits, and burlesque was the most popular form of entertainment in the teens, I guess, in this country. There were 80 burlesque shows in 1922 on the circuit alone, not counting many stock houses. Philadelphia had five, for example, five burlesque houses here. And this was, for the most part, relatively clean entertainment. It was rowdy comic entertainment, basically. The word burlesque has nothing to do with taking off your clothes, as you know. It suggests a certain kind of comedy. And the comedians were the great stars of burlesque during that period. The period I'm talking about coincides with the glory days of the Columbia Burlesque Circuit, which was the great burlesque circuit, and that's what we're trying to recall. You could get fired for saying hell or damn on the Columbia Circuit, so the humor was considerably tamer than humor we're accustomed to in the legitimate theater today.
But there's all these... Here's an example of one that I think... I forget who does it on the show last night, if it's Mickey Rooney when he's in drag. I think that's when it is. He says, sometimes I dance, and I dance a little with this leg, and I dance a little with that leg, and between both legs I make a lot of money.
Yeah.
Not a dirty word in that, but, you know.
There's not a dirty word in the whole show, but all of it's double entendre. The end of the schoolroom scene is a case in point, right? It's all in your imagination. In the schoolroom scene, a tough teacher played by Ann Miller administers pedagogical justice to a group of unruly students played by the comics. And Mickey, of course, is the principal offender who keeps getting hit on the head with a rolled-up newspaper. Anyway, the final lesson of the day is the difference between prose and poetry. She says to him, what's the difference between prose and poetry? He says, I don't know, teach. He said, well, I'll give you an example. If I were to say the girl went round the mulberry bush and I went round to meet her, that little girl will never know how glad I was to greet her. He says, what's that? She says, that's poetry. He says, oh, that's right, meet her and greet her. It rhymes. That's poetry. said, but if I were to say the girl went around the mulberry bush and I went around to meet her, that little girl will never know how glad I was that day. He said, what's that? She said, that's prose because it doesn't rhyme. He says, oh, poetry rhymes and prose doesn't. He says, I could do that. My girlfriend went around the mulberry bush and I went around to meet her. She pulled up her petticoat and I pulled out mine. Now, do you want prose or poetry? Right? So you really haven't said anything at all, but it's what we might call a double entendre.
So most of the comedy...
There's not a dirty word in it. No, there never is. Never was.
Right. So there's a minimum amount of striptease and flesh and stuff. But all the humor, at least in Sugar Babies, is certainly sexual humor relating to...
That's right. Sexual humor. Right, although there's some clean jokes, too, and some clean jokes that get big laughs. But most humor is either sexual or scatological because... comedy deals with human limitations, doesn't it? I mean, tragedy deals with human possibilities, we might say. People are trying to be more than human. But comedy deals with human limitations. The difference between our vision of ourselves as free and rational creatures and the fact that we are, in fact, creatures of instinct, not of will, this contrast between our vision of ourselves and what we really are is what comedy is all about. So what more, you know, we reach for the stars, but we have erections, or we have stones in our shoes, or we're bound to the earth in a variety of ways, and that's sort of what comedy's been about since Aristophanes. So you might expect most humor to be sexual or scatological.
A lot of the laughing that I did when I saw Sugar Babies was like, oh God, what a terrible joke! You know exactly what's coming, mm-hmm. And it's funny in part because it's funny, and it's funny because in part because it's not funny. And none of the humor at this point is the kind of thing that would make you blush.
Oh, no, it's very tame.
Was it the kind of thing that would make you blush in 1920?
Oh, I think it probably would have made you blush in 1905, yes. I think that our show is a little more risque than perhaps the shows were in those days. But, yes, it can't possibly make you blush. But there are a lot of things to be said about why burlesque is so appealing. For one thing, it is unsentimental. It's not a comedy of the Charlie Chaplin school. You're not asked to cry with the comedians. It relieves you of the responsibility of feeling. On the other hand, so many kinds of comedy that are unsentimental are bitter. You know, like the absurdist plays of Ionesco, for example, or like a great deal of avant-garde comedy in the 20th century. It's not bitter either. It's very cheerful about human nature. So it's neither sentimental nor bitter, and that's very appealing. It's also kind of wish fulfillment comedy. Because it's all about authority being toppled. There's always a straight man who's being undercut by the comedians.
Like the judge.
Yeah, right. The straight man in the judge scene is really the district attorney. He's the pretentious man who uses big words, and the comic is constantly undercutting him. And all of us, with part of our minds at least, want to see authority toppled. And so this is kind of wish fulfillment comedy of the most profound sort. But it's never threatening. You know, seeing authority toppled is a little threatening sometimes because it leaves you without any way of relating yourself to the world. It leaves you without... When traditional religion disappears, you the world feels rudderless, for example, for a while. But in burlesque, because the jokes are so reassuring, they're so old, no new ground is being broken, the conventions of the comedy are so kind of reassuring that the earth doesn't yawn at your feet. And you can enjoy watching authority toppled without being threatened by it. Does that make some sense?
Yeah.
Anyway... Besides, I make it sound more pretentious than it is. It's mostly basically good fun. There's nothing topical in burlesque either. They never, you know, it's not... No jokes about who's president or anything like that. They might throw in a casual remark or something, but it's about all the things that bother people. Basic insecurities, money and sex and things like that. Always amuses me when someone says that maybe it's the kind of play that would be offensive to, say, feminists. I've never thought so. It seems to me the women always win in burlesque. It's always about male impotence or male insufficiency.
That's an interesting thing, though.
Don't you think?
Well, looking at the way it's set up in Sugar Babies, for instance, the women are, without exception, beautiful and really idealized, perfectly formed, you know, in the chorus line.
Yeah.
And wearing very...
The chorus line would be happy to hear that. I'll tell them you said so.
Okay. And also usually wearing very little clothes. I don't mean G-strings or anything, but your basic chorus line costume, revealing as much breast and rump as...
We have very little flesh in this play by contemporary standards, don't you think?
Well, it's not like a singer coming out in an evening gown or a pantsuit, you know, singing a few songs.
That's true.
There's a lot of flesh, and then there's a lot of low-cut dresses, and the chorus girls will lean over so that the audience is going to, like, look down and see how much they can see. Mm-hmm. But the men in it, with the exception of a couple of men, are a lot older, because the women are all in their 20s, I'd say, mm-hmm. with the exception of Ann Miller, maybe a couple in their 30s. But the men are mostly in their 50s on up.
Mm-hmm.
And the women are all beautiful and wearing beautiful clothes. And the men are, particularly Mickey Rooney, wearing these grotesque costumes, baggy pants, suspenders that are twisted around the shoulder. And a lot of the allusions to male sexuality are equally grotesque, whereas the female sexuality is very alluring and sensual and teasing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what it is that in this sexy show that there should be this grotesqueness about male sexuality.
Well, there are a lot of... it's a very big question. I must say that one of the oldest jokes in the world is the mismatching of lovers. Wouldn't you say? I mean, in Roman comedy, for example, the big joke in Roman comedy are old men in heat pursuing young women for whom they're, to whom they're inappropriately matched, right? And also the reverse in Restoration comedy, for example, Lady Wishfort, aging sexual female sexuality pursuing inappropriate male partners, or inappropriate in the terms of the play. And so, of course, one of the basic jokes in burlesque is that the men aren't so attractive and the women are. That's certainly true, and that always has been true. The men adopt a stock costume much as clowns do in a circus to make a comment on human nature and to make a comment on the absurdity of the situations in which they're involved. But I have to say that one reason our men are older than our women in this play, this wasn't always true in burlesque. I mean, the burlesque comedians started as young men, and burlesque has died out. Nobody is learning burlesque routines anymore. So in the memory of most of the people listening to your program, the burlesque comedians were always older than the women because they were men who'd broken into show business 30 or 40 years before and were the only ones who could continue to play these stock scenes that have been handed down from generation to generation, which no young man was learning.
Mm-hmm. But still there's the baggy pants comedian.
That's right. Burlesque before the First World War was had a lot of ethnic humor in it, too. Comedians typically were Dutch comedians or Jewish, did Yiddish dialect, or they did Irish dialects, and they did very grotesque Irishmen with chin whiskers, and all Irishmen were blustering and drunk, and all Dutchmen were dumb and thick-headed and so forth. About in the First World War, this kind of humor went out. When we were fighting the Germans, it wasn't funny to be German. And the Irish societies objected to the portrayal of the Irish, so pretty soon that stereotype disappeared. And there is still, and still was, some traces of Yiddish humor in burlesque, because Yiddish humor is basic urban humor in this country, isn't it? I mean, you know, it's very basic to... burlesque was always slum entertainment. And... working-class entertainment and blue-collar entertainment, and the kind of characters that were made fun of in burlesque were the kind of people that people saw every day in working-class neighborhoods, and that's why the Irish and the Dutch and the immigrant types were the early dialect clowns in burlesque. But after the First World War, the baggy pants comic and the tramp comic became the basic stock figures that for whom the burlesque scenes were written. Very much like the blackface clowns and minstrel shows, they were the straight man is the pretentious asker of questions, and the low clown who has no pretensions, no beauty, no style, no physical attractiveness supplies the comic answers and undercuts the pretentious straight man.
Let's get into another stuck character, one that Mickey Rooney has his chance to play in
mm-hmm.
Sugar Babies, and that's the female impersonator, mm-hmm. where a man comes out wearing an evening gown or some lavish dress of mm-hmm. female garb with fake breasts
mm-hmm.
and does a song or two and a little routine, a few shticks. I know it's a standard part of burlesque, and certainly in the theater, mm-hmm. in Sugar Babies with the Night I Saw It, got a lot of laughs, and it was indeed a really good routine. And Mickey Rooney, I was very impressed with his skill in it. But I kept saying to myself, isn't it curious that most of these people in the theater would probably drop dead if a friend of theirs was a transvestite? What does it all mean?
Well, that is an interesting question. It's always been, in American variety entertainment, there have been a lot of famous female impersonators. Montague was a great female impersonator in burlesque. And Julian Eltinge on the legitimate stage made his living as a female impersonator. So did Tony Hart. In burlesque, it all comes again from minstrel shows, where it was an all-male performance. And so when they did afterpieces, the wenches, as they called them, because it was all done in blackface, were played by men, and there were specialists in that. The famous one in the late minstrel shows was called the Divine Leon. But you're perfectly right. It's a kind of... I'm reminded of a poem. Do you know a poem by L.A.G. Strong about the Abbey Theatre in Dublin? I'll recite it very fast for you.
Go ahead.
He says, "In this theatre they has plays on us." This is a woman from the slums outside the Abbey Theatre. "In this theatre they has plays on us, and high-born people come and pay to see things playing here they'd run like hell from in the slums." And in a sense, it's the same problem. Female impersonation has, for the most part, except in cult situations in this country, has kind of died out. But in England, it's still going strong as the popularity of Danny LaRue and Mrs. Shufflewick and dozens of other performers attest. And those performers play not to cult audiences of homosexuals, for example, but to... But to coach parties from Lancashire and old ladies who seem to be delighted at this even when the humor is very blue, which it sometimes is.
Does it confuse you?
I don't know. One of the show that we're commemorating in the finale, that you're talking about, the finale of the first act of Sugar Babies, which is set up to be a female minstrel show. As I told you, burlesque came from minstrel shows, and one of the early burlesque shows was a female minstrel show called Madame Rentz's Female Minstrels. M.B. Levitt, this man I told you about earlier, had the wonderful idea of combining the British leg show, like Lydia Thompson and her London Blondes, with girls in tights and things, with the conventions of the minstrel show. And he did a white-face minstrel show called Madame Rentz's All-Female Minstrel Show. And we thought we would do that originally with Ann Miller as the interlocutor, the straight man, who also sings and dances, and the two comedians, Mickey Rooney and Jimmy Matthews originally, as end men. It was perfectly possible in a minstrel show to do specialty numbers, too, to do for someone to come out and do a kind of a monologue. And Mickey Rooney created that character, Francine, in rehearsal. It came out of rehearsal. And this old dancing girl was going bald, who, as you say, dances on her right leg, dances on her left leg, between the two of them makes a lot of money, who wears black garters in memory of those who passed above, who has lived a life of that had some difficulties in it. And I think what's kind of marvelous about the way he plays it is it's not full of drag jokes, we might call. It's not full of... he plays the character. And he plays that silly... I mean, he plays, of course, a kind of comic strip character, but he plays with great conviction that...
With a certain affection.
Yeah, and with a certain affection, the woman who has suffered through various vicissitudes in her life and who seems to be fairly resilient. It's actually the bluest material in the play, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's the material that comes... But it... Mickey Rooney, I have to say, I think some of you will be surprised by Mickey Rooney. I think... people have forgotten in the years that Mickey Rooney has been out of the public eye what a great talent this is. And he is a great talent. He really is. He's overwhelming in this play. He kind of dominates it.
Did you know you'd be writing sketches that he would be doing?
Well, when we first started to put this play together, Harry Rigby, the producer, who is the other, in a sense, conceiver of the play with me, and I have been talking about this play, this review, for 2 years. We talked about various people, but right from the first, we thought Mickey Rooney would be ideal to do this kind of clown. His father was a famous burlesque comedian, Joe Yule, and Mickey has tremendous talent as a low comedian. I mean, he's kind of overwhelming, and he's such an inventive man, He's constantly thinking of odd readings and unusual readings. And I think people who have forgotten Mickey or forgotten what a great talent he is will be surprised and pleasantly to see how charming he is. He's charming, too. This material can either be loathsome or charming. And with Mickey, it's very charming because he's unpretentious. He's not trying to recall what he was or trying to pretend he's anything he isn't. He's very generous in the way he uses the stage and lets the other performers kind of score. And he uses everything he really is. He's bald and he's fat and he's getting on and he's short and all the rest of it. And he gleefully takes advantage of all that and therefore gives the audience a very modest impression of himself, I think. Do you know what I mean? The
yeah.
persona is very charming, and I know that there will be other companies of this play if it's a success in New York, and Mr. Rigby and I have been wondering who in the world we would ever get who could combine all those qualities as he does.
Could we talk a little bit about the one-liner?
Yeah, one-liners. Well, Burlesque really wasn't full of one-liners. We have a lot of jokes in this play, but Burlesque was situation humor, but basically. It isn't like stand-up comedy, one-line jokes, although we have a lot of jokes in the play. But I found in working on this play and in rearranging the old jokes and putting together these scenes that if you ever get a joke out of context, even if it's basically a funny joke, out of the situation, it won't work. We've taken jokes and put them in places where they didn't belong and had the audience absolutely silent. So Burlesque is situation humor, essentially. In the courtroom scene, right, a lecherous judge is presiding over a murder trial in which a beautiful woman is accused of shooting her husband. And the scene is full of double entendre. I mean, it's a raucous scene and a raucous parody. Justice is blind in this scene, and it also has other infirmities. Straight man, the district attorney, says, "Stand on your dignity, judge," as he ogles the defendant. "Stand on your dignity," says, "I don't think it'll reach that far." Well, it's a fairly grotesque view of the relationship between a judge and his client. And yet, it's... It could be very offensive, I think, if it weren't handled with such charm by Mickey. Do you understand what I mean?
I agree,
you know, it could be. It's this is all risky material, and his great charm and his great. But what I'm trying to say, there are jokes. But if you get those jokes out of context, if you do those jokes and they don't seem to fit the situation, you'll find that they aren't funny at all. And we tried to put jokes from other scenes into the plays to plug up places that weren't going very well, and it didn't work.
Tell me what you think of this. I had a feeling that if the review that I was seeing when I saw Sugar Babies wasn't based on material from the past, that I might have reacted really differently to it. I had a good time. I had a feeling I was fairly certain. If I was seeing a row of chorus girls mm-hmm. who were supposed to be very blonde and very stupid, with a lot of flesh pouring out of skimpy clothes, and it didn't have a certain reference to the past, that I would really wonder what was going on in the mind of the scriptwriter and the producer and the people who were putting it on.
Well, you're right in a sense. The choreography and all the rest of it is deliberately naive. We are trying to recall the past. We are trying, in part, to do a historical exercise. But only in part. I have to say, in defense of that kind of show business, which the show business is always based to some extent on the physical attractiveness of performers, both male and female. Clark Gable wasn't much of an actor. What he sold essentially was sex appeal. And so sex appeal has always been a part of this kind of show business. I have to say that.
We get back to that in this form of...
Well, we got a handsome singer for the girls.
Right.
We got a handsome singer. They always did. They always had a juvenile who was supposed to be a heartthrob. And, however, it was a male-oriented entertainment because not a lot of women went to burlesque shows. And so, naturally, it was to some extent men whose sexual interests were being pandered to in the old burlesque. I must say, though, I have to defend our show. We have no skin at all showing. They're always wearing tights. We were trying to be very careful about accurately representing the kind of show business that existed from 1905 to 1930. I mean, we mostly wanted to entertain people, but we felt that we could create a style. We cannot compete with hardcore pornography or with what burlesque and things like that have degenerated into, nor did we want to recall the striptease era, which begins about 1930. We wanted to do it. And so really, they're very, you know, they're pretty thoroughly dressed, those girls. They don't, in the fan dance, for example, which Sally Rand did nude, they were encased in a body stocking from head to foot, and not any flesh is being seen at all. And in the chorus girls in the Sugar Babies number that begins are very kind of heavily dressed. They really are. Certainly, we want them to look attractive because, indeed, that's what this kind of entertainment was built on, as you point out. But we're not trying to titillate the audience very much.
We're almost out of time. We've got a couple of minutes. This is a big request. It's hard to compress this kind of thing, but can you just allude briefly to the effect on musical comedies and on musical movies that the burlesque had?
Well, these raucous variety, what I should say, we've been talking a lot about the chorus numbers. The basic units of burlesque were the comic scenes. And they were stock scenes, like the Westfall murder case or schoolroom scenes, into which each comedian put his own personality. And it was a training ground for comedians. Most of the great comic stars in the musical theater came out of burlesque. I think of Bert Lahr. I think of James Barton, who went on to play Tobacco Road, W.C. Fields, Jackie Gleason, Phil Silvers, Rags Ragland, Red Buttons in the later era. Before that, Clark and McCullough. It was where you got your early training. It was where, you learned how to do comic material. And burlesque was a kind of a poor man's musical comedy in the old days. The songwriters wrote songs for burlesque, and that's where songs were plugged. It was a kind of respectable entertainment around the turn of the century. I mean, it wasn't the kind of entertainment that when I was growing up, if you went down to the truck, you sneaked down. You didn't tell your mother, but that wasn't so in the early part of the century, and it was where an awful lot of show business people got their start. Some women too, Fanny Bryce notably, but others as well. Barbara Stanwyck. Who else? Oh, dozens. Sophie Tucker, Blossom Seeley. All started in burlesque, and it was sort of the kind of basic training ground for and. This kind of low humor is very American, I think, and informed. I mean, the Ziegfeld Follies was just a glorified burlesque show, but so much of legitimate musical comedy borrows from the conventions of burlesque and vaudeville.
Well, Ralph Allen, we're out of time now, but I hope that I know you're going back to Tennessee, where you're a professor of theater. I hope that when you stop back again in Philadelphia, that you'll let us know so that you could come back. To fresh air and talk with us some more about
lovely,
burlesque.
Yeah, I'd love to. And they should go and see Sugar Babes. They'd be surprised. It's fun. It's a lot of fun.
Ralph Allen, I look forward to your book, Gaieties, coming out, a book about burlesque. Thanks a lot for stopping in.
Thank you.
And
thank
I hope
you,
that
Terry.
We get a chance to talk again on the air sometime.
Right. Thank you very much.
Ralph Allen, my guest, is a professor of theater at the University of Tennessee. He's the author of a forthcoming book on burlesque and wrote the sketches that are now being acted in Sugar Babies, the burlesque musical that's in Philadelphia now and headed for New York. Thanks again for being here. This is Fresh Air. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia.